For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, so if you have been following the story along with us, the Hebrews have gotten out of Egypt. They've worked their way all the way down now, finally to the base of this mountain. And we ended up last week, I guess it was a couple weeks ago now, with, you know, this cloud, flames rumbling, a mountain shaking, everybody's freaking out. They're not allowed to touch the mountain. They got this barrier up there. They're supposed to stay behind that. And so everything is finally said, and everyone's standing there now, and it's time for God to speak. And so God busts out with really one of the most famous pieces in the history of the world, the so-called Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. It's a classic statement of ethical norms. There's also some interesting other literary parallels. Meredith Klein's a professor. It's actually a dude. Meredith is a dude. Who wrote kind of the definitive piece on the parallels between Old Testament covenant literature, like the Ten Commandments, and also like the book of Deuteronomy, which kind of restates this in a more verbose form. And one of the things he pointed out is that they follow a form that is identical to the way that treaties were made in the ancient world between a great power like an empire and their vassal states. And they call these suzerainty treaties, where a vassal state would agree that they would be followers, basically clients of the great king. And this literary form was a form that was in use in this day, and God used a literary genre that people were familiar with, which he still does. It makes sense that God would speak to people in the vernacular, you know, in their own language. Like in the New Testament, it's written in Greek, but there's Attic Greek, you know, there was Hellenistic Greek. That's really very formal, very difficult, but the New Testament is not written in that. It's written in Koine Greek, the Greek of the streets. And it just shows that God comes at people where they're at. But this also has an interesting side point to it, okay? Klein points out that it's especially noteworthy that the second millennium Hittite suzerain vassal treaties exhibit the same five parts as the Mosaic Decalogue and the whole book of Deuteronomy. And so he goes through the announcement of who the great king is and so forth, and it's uncanny. The structure that it follows is identical. But the first millennium treaties that we have, for instance, of the Assyrians, follow a different form and are missing key components found in that earlier version of the treaty. What does this mean? It means if, again, what liberal scholarship argues, that this literature was written by, you know, shepherd editors in the 700s BC, how would they know what the suzerainty treaty forms were in use 1,000 years before their day, and use that rather than the form that was in use in their own day? There's no way. And so it's just another one of these, indications that this liberal scholarship's wrong on this. This literature was second millennium, 1400 BC, not 700 as they claim. Anyway, in this, he's going to spell out God. Now everyone's standing there and they're like, okay, so what are you going to say to us, God? And he's going to spell out the terms of the covenant, which is what these commandments are all about. These also then stand as a description of God's moral expectations on people. and what they need to live up to. And they end up being a continual reminder to anybody that honestly faces them of how we fall short every single day of our lives, and that we cannot reach, we cannot live up to God's moral expectations. And so, of course, then there's a second part to the covenant, which is, okay, and then if you don't do what you're supposed to here, then you're going to need a sacrifice. You're going to need someone to substitute. And this is where the picture comes in. You know, it's really a foreshadowing of the work of Jesus Christ. Let's jump in, though. Exodus 20, verse 1, then God gave the people all these words. I am Yahweh, your God, who rescued you from the land of Egypt, from the place of your slavery. And so we begin, I am Yahweh. Now, why should we begin there? Why, you know, that you don't want to just read over this. This is actually a very important part of this whole presentation. I am Yahweh. That's the first thing we need to understand. The reason we need to start here is because if there were no God, then there would be no objective morality either. The existence and nature of God is necessary in order for there to be objective morals. Let's think about a world where there's no God. That's what a lot of people believe today. A growing number. In fact, the number of people who subscribe to no religion of any kind has doubled in the past 15 years. It's the fastest growing faith group in America are unbelievers. So, okay, let's think about that. A world without God. It's a material world. It's a world, you know, we see matter, we see energy, we see physical laws, and that's the world. That would be the whole world. And there would be nothing other than our material existence. The problem is, matter is not moral. Ludwig Wittgenstein, a philosopher, an Austrian philosopher and British, lived in both countries, also linked up with the positive, with the objectivist school in Austria, and one of the fathers of linguistic analysis. A guy who, you know, coming from a materialistic standpoint of starting from me and looking out at the world, one of the things that struck him is that, you know, our perceptions and our language have limitations. We can speak about things only within the construct of our own, you know, linguistic world. He gave a lecture at Cambridge on ethics that this comes from, where he says, if we describe a murder with all its details, physical and psychological, the mere description of these facts will contain nothing which we could call an ethical proposition. The murder would be on exactly the same level as any other event. For instance, the falling of a stone. You know, a stone rolls down a hill. Is that moral? Is that ethically good? Ethically evil? He says, we can look at an event like a murder and describe it. And it's like, okay, that event happened. But what is the moral content in that? He says, our words, use as we use them in a science, are vessels capable only of containing and conveying meaning and sense. That is natural meaning and sense. Ethics, if it is anything, is supernatural. And our words will only express facts, as a teacup will only hold a teacup full of water. Even if I pour a gallon into it, it still only holds a cup. And he says, no state of affairs has in itself what I would like to call the coercive power of an absolute judge. He says, to write or to talk ethics or religion is to run against the boundaries of language this running against the walls of our cage is perfectly, absolutely hopeless. This is the man without God. Wittgenstein is a brilliant thinker. And if you look out at the world from that perspective, from the no God perspective, this is exactly what you do wind up with. Inability to know moral truth. Because, as he says, it's not a natural event. All we can look at is nature, matter reacting to physical law, energy. That's not moral. So matter is not a moral thing. And yet, in the no-God world, what do we have? Matter. That's all. How then do we get from what is to what ought to be? See, when he just talks about describing a murder, that's what is. Okay, so what's moral about it? What's ethical about it? Nowhere to turn. Humans under this system would be just like every other species. And this is exactly the conclusion that so many in our own day are reaching, have reached. This is the basis of much thinking in animal rights, for example, is that why do we, you know, isn't it arrogant for us to think our species is different? That speciesism, that's thinking that we're superior to other species, that we have the right to use other species, humans, thinking that we're special, different. Not in a no-God world. It would be impossible, this thinker says, to find a fox which has a kindly and protective disposition toward geese, just as no cat exists which has a friendly disposition toward mice. That's why the struggle between the various species does not arise from a feeling of mutual antipathy, but rather from hunger and love for the kittens at home, for the baby foxes. They have to be cared for. A prey has to be secured for that. Is that evil? I don't think so. In both cases, nature looks on calmly and is even pleased with what happens. Of course, this is the way nature works. The nutrients have to be cycled through the ecosystem. This is necessary. There cannot be a separate law then for mankind in a world in which planets and suns follow their orbits, where moons and planets trace their destined paths. Man must also submit to the eternal principles of this supreme wisdom. You see his point. What makes a planet follow the same path every time it rotates and revolves? Physics. It's matter. And so planets don't decide, well, I think I'll go a different path this time around or anything. It's a material object. It does what the forces of gravity and the momentum behind it and the mass, it's all predictable. It's all determined. And just like everything else in nature, and we cannot argue for a separate law for humans, like we're different, we're not a part of any of this. Yeah, I see his point. I think he's got it. In the no-God world, your author here, Adolf Hitler, from Mein Kampf. That's exactly what he thought. And he was consistent to them. Eradicating the Jew was getting rid of vermin, you know. And they're all material objects anyway. It's a struggle for survival. What's the problem? And so here, it's pretty hard, frankly, to start in that no-God thesis, in that materialistic thesis as your beginning point, and then end up somehow with normative, objective morals. Humans would be, yeah, why is it okay for me to fly, to swat a fly? Nothing wrong with that. It's an animal. Why is the human? Why can't I swat a human and exterminate a human? That's way more annoying, perhaps, than a fly to me right now. Is it only because I'm afraid of getting caught and getting retaliation? Is that the only reason? The whole concept of moral right and wrong sits like a house built in the air. There's no foundation. Atheists like to point out, hey, we can have morals. You know, what are you, crazy? You think we can't have morals? Yeah, you can have them, but they have no basis. There's no, they don't fit. They don't follow from your beginning point. And so it's just this concept of morality just floating without any foundation whatsoever and without any base. So we read Sam Harris, one of the four horsemen of the new atheists. He says, we can be good without God. We don't need God or a Bible to tell us what's right and what's wrong. We can know objective moral truths without the existence of a law-giving God. And we can judge Hitler to be morally reprehensible without reference to Scripture. Yeah, so we can make these moral judgments. But what's the basis? What's it based on? It's completely arbitrary. And so what we're really ending up with is that any moral tradition or system has equal validity to any other moral system, which namely is nothing except for subjective preference. That's what we end up with. So we can look over and we can, you know, when we look at fascist Germany, they felt like Hitler had a pretty good point. They didn't have a problem with it. So in their moral tradition, they decided that was good and it was worth fighting for. We say, well, that was terrible. Really? Based on what? I mean, Harris is like, we can do this. We can decide to have morals. Yeah, but if there's no basis for it, the next guy can decide to have the other moral. And so this has happened and does happen over and over again. Secondly, not only is the existence and nature of God the basis for all moral thinking, but if God is not there, and if I deny God's existence, I take on the place of God in his place. Or I create a God. Dawkins in The God Delusion says, the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. That's his view of the God of the Old Testament. Pretty low. Okay, who says? Who says that God is all these things? Dawkins? So Dawkins really then is saying that I am the source of this judgment, then he basically has taken the place of God. That's essentially what we're left with. If there is no God to base things on, then I become the base. And one of the ways to do this is by creating God. Instead of saying, oh, I'm God, we say, oh, I have this God. And we create a God of our liking, a God that is an extrapolation from our thinking. Oh, I just believe it's this way. And yeah, I just believe God's like really like this. And so we create God in our image, which is a way to supplant God and not to be under his authority, but to kind of become the creator ourselves, the creator God. Well, so to the conclusion that I'm kind of driving toward here, morality is not a matter of pieces in a machine and the way they work together, such as the material world is essentially that. You know, when we look at the planet Earth, there's moving tectonic plates, there are tides in the ocean, there are weather events going on. It's all matter energy responding to physical law. There's no mind making these things happen. Come on, we live in the modern era. We know better than you know, thinking that somebody is making a volcano happen. It's caused by tectonic friction in a fault line. And it's all material, it's all a big machine, and you don't find morality in that. Moral thinking is a personal form of thinking. It starts with a personal being. His name is Yahweh. And that is God's first point on Yahweh. That's our starting point right there. And there is a starting point because God is actually there. We're not imagining that we're moral beings. We're not imagining that we are different. The Bible declares that God created humans in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. He imbued us with what Wittgenstein said must exist for morality to be there, which is a supernatural component. You see it in yourself. You can tell that you're you. Your unconsciousness, your mind, it's right there. We all sense it. Yeah, I have a body. That part's physical. There's someone else in here. I'm in here. And I know that. And that accords perfectly, so we're perceiving things correctly at this point. And that is that we are the special creations of a personal, infinite God. And he says, I am Yahweh who rescued you from the land of Egypt. And so in this covenant with this group of people, God had recently done something pretty important, which we've been reading about. He rescued them from a really bad situation. They were slaves. They were being tormented. And so he rescued them out of that. And so what we're really saying is he's not just like the voice, you know, in the Drano commercial, you know, no, not that way, the other way. But actually Yahweh, I'm the guy that has been working in your life. I'm the guy that just rescued you. You and me are involved with each other. So there is relationship here. And it's a loving relationship. It's a rescuing relationship. So it's impossible for people to comprehend God's moral nature until we enter into a relationship with Him. And it's in that context that the moral nature of God starts to make sense. That God also has then access to us to begin to change us, to give us the power to change from one thing to a different thing. That all has to do with the relationship between us and God. So God's not just a philosophical entity out there. He's a being that has a relationship of love to us. And we basically realize that morality cannot be an impersonal matter. It is intensely personal. Impersonal things exist. The chair is impersonal. That chair is incapable of morality. Morality always has to do with personal beings in relationship, and it's all about that. It's about the relationship between God and His people and between us and other people, also personal beings, and that's where morality starts to come into play. This Decalogue, these Ten Commandments, is all about that. When they came up to Jesus during His ministry, they said, so what is really most important for us to understand from the law? He said, the most important law is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And he said, I can't really just give you one. I got to give you two. The second, just like it, he says, is to love your neighbor as yourself. So it's loving God. That's the beginning point. But that leads to loving others. And so we find in the Decalogue that the first laws, the one we're going to look at tonight, have to do with my relationship with God, which is where I need to begin. And then the rest of them all have to do with my relationship to other people, which is where it all leads. That's what happens to you when you enter into relationship with God. Listen to these sentiments just from various points in Scripture. I cried out to the Lord and he answered me, Psalm 3. Or, my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory in Philippians 4. How about, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Psalm 23, famous line from that psalm. You're with me. You're protecting me, taking care of me. Do not fear, little flock. This is Jesus. He says, do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. God is happy for what he can give you. See, this is what we have to understand. If you want to understand how moral thinking works, then you got to understand the love of God and the relationship that we can have with God, which is intensely personal and spiritual. And that becomes the basis then for all moral thinking, is based on that. Deuteronomy 10. This is also written by Moses a few years later. He says, you must keep the Lord's commandments and his statutes, which I am commanding you today for your good. That, see, it's not just God. Like, God is not trying to restrict us. He's not trying to bar us away from great and exciting things. God is, if he says, here's the moral way to live, it's because that's for your own good. Take it easy on yourself. Don't destroy your life. Don't think that you can violate the character of God and still do well. That's not going to happen. You need to realize, I'm giving you this so that you can be happy. And it's because he loves us. This is why a guy like Dawkins or Harris will never grasp. You know, if you don't grasp the love of God, it's impossible to accept anything he says as being morally valid. This part comes first. And so then he goes on, you must not have any other God but me. Okay, now why do we have to have a rule like that? Why can't we have any other God? In the first place, there is no other God. God's quite adamant on that point. Isaiah 40, I am God and there is no other. I'm the only one up here. So where do these other gods come from then? If God's like, I know I'm God and I know that I'm the only God, then where do these other gods come from? Clearly they are man-made, that we create them. And we create gods who are probably in accordance with what we want things to be like. That is, they're over against the true God who really is there. We have all these ancient law codes that we found. Not a single one of them prohibits the worship of other gods. Monotheism. This is the only one in the whole ancient world. Think about that for a moment. Wonder how that happened. How did these guys just happen to come up with that? Maybe they didn't come up with it. Maybe they had God himself talking to them on this mountain, like it says. He says, you must not make for yourself an idol of any kind or an image of any kind in the heavens or on the earth or on the sea. This, of course, is the desire humans have to bring God from his transcendent, unimaginable, you know, state down to something tangible, down to something that I can put in my pocket and pull out and rub, you know, to get some oomph going. and yet this desire that religious people have to have an idol, to have a talisman, a charm, to have some physical point of contact with God, is essentially an impersonal, it's a desire to relate to God in an impersonal way. Instead of treating him as the personal being he is, we want an object that we can relate to, an object of the senses. and religion is this way. Worldwide, tragically, including so-called Christian churches, which are rife with this themselves, as though for all the world, like they never read this. Verse 5, you must not bow down to them, you must not worship them, for I, the Lord, am your God. And I'm jealous God who will not tolerate your affection for any other gods. Okay, Martin Luther pointed out that whatever your heart clings to and relies on, that properly is your God. So, of course, today, the carving of idols and the offering of incense to idols is not big in the West. Not still big in many parts of the world today, but we've kind of drifted away from that in our materialism. But we have not drifted away from formulating and creating gods other than the true God, than Yahweh. As Luther points out here, it could be security. That's what we've centered our life on, is I'm going to try to be a secure person. I'm going to try to hedge my life with all of these protections. I'm going to be so successful, so wealthy, so, well invested, so well insured. I'll be safe and secure. It could be my position. I want to ascend up to this glorified position that everybody will admire. And that's what we think about. We get up in the morning. We're already busy. You know, we can't stop. It's our fantasy life. This is what occupies our mind. Or is it power? Like some people who love that sense. Boy, I say jump and they say how high. And some of us thirst for power and control. Could be social prestige. Just being admired by everybody. Oh, he's so amazing. I wish I could spend time with that person. And we just imagine that. That's what we dream about. Some people put love of country here. They actually are fanatically patriotic. And this constitutes kind of the centerpiece in their thinking, the hub of the wheel that everything rotates around. There's people like that. Others, it's love of family. And family becomes the be-all and the end-all. You know, so many of these things are things that are not inherently wrong. This is a perfect example. What's wrong with loving your family? Nothing, unless that becomes the center of your life and you're making everything in your life rotate around that. And now that has taken the place of God in your life. That's having other gods before me. The reason that God doesn't want us to do this is because of how damaging and destructive it is. Imagine basing your life on the love of your family and then having that family implode and break to pieces, as it happens so often all the time around us, and which is predictable that it will happen because we're expecting something from the family that it can never deliver. And instead, we should understand, if you want a successful family, you need to get under the leadership of God. Put that family under God's leadership. Yeah. Career. People view their career like a god. They'll do anything for it. Sever any relationship. Move wherever. Ruin their own family for the sake of their career. Yeah, that's having another god in front of me. Max Dunham says, not uncommon for any of these to replace God as our first commitment. No, it's not. It's super common, as a matter of fact. Let's just talk for a second about him saying, I am a jealous God. I think one of the problems here is a problem in translation. Dawkins says God breaks into a monumental rage whenever his chosen people are caught flirting with a rival god, resembling nothing so much as sexual jealousy of the worst kind.
Yeah. Well, Dawkins has attitude problems when it comes to God, to say the least. Actually,
Dunham points out that the word used for jealousy here comes from a Hebrew root that means to be red in the face. It really doesn't necessarily mean jealousy. And he says, really, in the Old Testament, it does not connect with the human emotion that we associate with envy, pettiness, and suspicion. This is a traditional translation that goes back to the King James. I'm a jealous God. But I think it's a questionable translation because, for one thing, one of the things that makes humans jealous is insecurity and feeling, threatened in a relationship. We become jealous. God is not insecure at all, ever. So I find it odd to use that word of him. And also, it raises content questions. Why would the Bible say that love is not jealous, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 13? And yet God's saying, I am jealous. I think it's a bad translation. I think, and I'm not alone in this, a number of commentators think it should be translated something like passionate or zealous, because it is used that way in many Old Testament passages, not about jealousy as we think of that word. On another level, Elton Trueblood says of this verse, he says, this is a commandment warning against taking God lightly. That carries a certain amount of weight with me. Kopar says divine jealousy should be seen as God's willing the best for his creatures. See, one difference between us and God is that if I saw my girlfriend talking to another guy, I might be jealous. And it would be really for selfish reasons, you know, because I don't want her having eyes for another guy. That's pretty far from what we're talking about here. It's very far from what we're talking about here with God. With God, he alone, he's the only being who can honestly say, if you don't relate to me, then that's going to lead to self-destruction. God's zeal to have us not stray to other gods is because that would be the worst thing that could happen to us. It's not that he's being selfish. It's that he's worried about our well-being, and that is what he's pointing out here. C.S. Lewis says, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but really too weak. We're half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition. When infinite joy is offered us, we're like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We're far too easily pleased. This is really the position that God is in, is that you're occupying yourself with these other gods. And sometimes people even tormenting themselves for the sake of these other gods, when real happiness is available right over here with God. And that excites his zeal. God finds that very upsetting. He gets red in the face as he sees people turning away from him to these other gods. And he's not dispassionate. He's not a brain in a bottle. He's a being who cares and who is a passionate, caring God. So it's very upsetting for him. He says, I'm visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations to those who hate me. This is really referring to cause and effect, is all it's referring to. It's not inherited guilt, because we know that the Bible teaches, the same text tells us that God does not practice inherited guilt. For example, Ezekiel 18:19 says, the son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor the father will not bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. Everybody will suffer for their own sin. That's biblical teaching. What he's talking about here with the iniquity of the fathers visited on the children to the third and fourth generation is simple cause and effect. If somebody is an alcoholic, that's a violation of God's will. And so that guy comes home, beats his wife, mistreats his children, abandons the family. The children didn't do anything wrong, but they will pay a price for that. And many of us sitting in this room know this all too well, right? And we're paying a price to this day for the crap that was laid down on us by parents. And in many cases, they're the way they were because it was laid down on them by their parents. And this can go on for several generations very easily. Yeah. Dysfunctionality is contagious, and it tends to perpetuate itself. Why is it that over 90% of child abusers were themselves victims of abuse? Yeah. It's because the iniquities of the fathers pass on to the children, to the third and the fourth generation. This is really God, this is called passive judgment, where God's like, I'm not going to prevent this from happening. So you're not only hurting yourself, you're hurting your children and their children. And so it's really bad. Then he says, but I lavish unfailing love to 1,000 generations on those who love me and keep my commandments. So the comparison here is thousands compared to 3 or 4. So when people hate me, it could easily impact 3 or 4 generations. But when people love me, I drive that down for 1,000 generations. And God is basically saying here that he's way more eager to bless people than he is to punish them. That he's a God of grace. He says, you must not misuse the name of the Lord your God. The Lord will not let you go unpunished if you misuse his name. I like the NLT's rendering here, misuse, because the NASB and the King James say, you shall not use the name of the Lord in vain. I think saying in vain is a questionable, again, a questionable translation. Like people in the Fundy Church are so worried about using God's name, you know, swearing. It's one of the worst things. I'm real, real upset about that. What do you make of Deuteronomy 6, where God says you must fear the Lord your God and serve him? When you take an oath, you should use only his name. Wait a minute. Swearing an oath by the name of God? There it is. It's God saying, if you're going to take an oath, you need to take it by my name. This is so you say, as the Lord lives, such and so. Or may God, may God cut me down if I don't come through on this oath. It's an oath, promise, sworn with the name of God. And here it's prescribed for us. So I think this actually, for one thing, using the Lord's name in vain is a little weak translation for this term, which normally is translated falsely. Do not use the Lord's name falsely. And probably is referring to swearing false oaths by the name of God, or possibly magic, where in the ancient world, if you knew somebody's true name, they would actually have public names that they put out, but their true name would be kept secret because they believed people could gain power over you if they knew your name. They could use divination and practice magic on you with the use of your name. And so it was, you see this in the Old Testament, as a matter of fact, in quite a few places. The power of bestowing a name and the power of knowing someone's name. And God is basically saying, I'm giving you my name. I don't want to see it being misused. Falsely would be swearing oaths saying, I swear by God, this, that, and the other thing, and it's false, and you know it. That's a false oath. And he says, I'll get you for that. That is totally disrespectful. And that is just like giving God the finger there. That's like daring God to do something. And he says, I will. Or even worse would be trying to practice magic, gain power over God by using his name. That would be a misuse of the name of God. Well, he says, remember to observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. You have 6 days each week. You can do your ordinary work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath day of rest dedicated to the Lord your God. On that day, no one in your household may do any work. This includes you, your sons, your daughters, your male and female servants, livestock, and the foreigners living around. Everybody gets a day off. For in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and everything in them. But on the seventh day, he rested. That's why the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and he set it apart as holy. And so the last part of this introduction about your relationship with me is that God says, I'm setting a day apart to mark this covenant. It's going to be the Sabbath day. We already discussed this because he actually rolled this out earlier, remember, when they were up on their way down to Sinai. That's when he first rolled out the Sabbath day when it had to do with manna. And they didn't go out and get any manna that day. That was the first discussion of this. And we talked about the Sabbath day already. We talked about the symbolism of it. In a word, it's a unique kind of a mark of this covenant. The Sabbath didn't exist before this Mosaic covenant. And this was the point at which God said, I'm going to set apart one day a week. We saw that it's good for us to have a day of rest. So that principle's still there. It's good for us to set apart time to stop all of our fussing and to think about God for a little while. We also saw that we're not under this covenant anymore, so the Sabbath day is specifically abrogated in the New Testament. And instead, it says that all days are alike, as a matter of fact. It also says don't let anyone be your judge when it comes to a Sabbath day. Just read recently an incredibly bizarre article by a normally respected scholar. I'm not even going to speak his name. This article is so shameful and pitiful, where he steer wrestled verses in the Bible and other evidence to try to make a case that this law is still in effect, but now it's just changed from Saturday to Sunday. Sabbath, it starts Friday evening and goes to Saturday evening. And Christians want to say, oh, yeah, well, ours is Sunday. No, we don't have a Sabbath day anymore. As we saw when we studied this earlier, we enter that greater rest that has to do with resting in the finished work of Christ. That's our rest, and that's what this really was a prefiguring of. Not trying to earn our way to God, but resting in the fact that Jesus has done it all for us, and we get that free access to God. Okay. So here are the first four commandments. We got six more to go. What we've seen so far, first of all, that good and evil are real. Moral thinking, morality is real. And as a matter of fact, they're not socially constructed. Societies can construct moralities. They do that all the time. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, okay? I'm just saying they can construct whatever they want, but behind any of these socially constructed moral theories is the overarching real morality of Almighty, infinite Creator God. And in this sense, then, right and wrong are objective. What we mean by that, subjective would mean, to me, this is right. To me, this is wrong in here. These are not in here. These are out there. Object. I'm the subject. This is the object. And morality is objective. It's universal because God is objective and he's universal. And it's the infinite personal God who created this place is the basis for moral thinking. And that we've seen in the beginning of this so-called Decalogue. And we also saw that it begins that appreciating Moral thinking begins with a personal relationship with God. It's in relationship that morality makes sense. Sometimes people will come to, I've talked to many non-Christians, they're like, oh, so you're a Christian. So do you think this is wrong? You think this is a sin? What do you think about that? And they want to talk about ethics. They want to talk about morals. I'm like, I can't discuss this with you. You don't know God. You don't have a relationship with God. How could we ever agree on any moral principle? If we did, it would just be nothing but coincidence. You know, there wouldn't be any reason for it. There has to be a basis for what you think morally, you know, is right or wrong. And that basis is that relationship with the Almighty God that created us. So you can get a relationship going like that with God. The beautiful thing is here is that God is a God of love. Yeah, he is a God of justice. That's true. He judges wrongdoing, but he's gone to an incredible length to make it possible for us to know him, to not be answerable, to not be subject to his justice, but to be able to have access to his love. And this is what Jesus was all about. This is why he died on the cross. So you can come to know God if you invite Christ, if you say, I want the death of Christ to apply to me, then all of your violations of God's law are swept away, paid for by Christ. And then you can have relationship with God. Well, from here, what we learn is that once you plug into a relationship with God, once you realize who we're dealing with here, I am Yahweh, and you realize that part, then it kind of takes self out of the center. No longer am I trying to basically define reality based on me, but I'm defining it based on him. And so then instead of being a self-taker, I become a self-giver. I'm able to become a giver at that point. And that second part of what Jesus referred to, the first law is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second one is to love your neighbor as yourself. That becomes possible. Now, once we get that relationship in place with God, and the rest of these commandments are all about that second part, what it means to love our neighbor as ourselves. So let's draw the line there for tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.